Joining us this morning is Dr. Christopher Kremer, who's an author and journalist, and a former ABC journalist, in fact, and is the author of Inhaling the Mahatma, and joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Trevor.
Now, have you been listening to the cricket?
Look, I have been following it at a distance, and you can probably update me with the latest. We had them in a tight spot on the final day, I believe.
Yeah, and basically the rain came along and that was the end of that.
Doesn't seem to be going our way this tour.
No, we got 3 for 30-odd, I think it was, and then rain finished play.
Oh, there you go. It always rains in England, doesn't it?
Yeah, there certainly is. Someone's sent a text, and I know this may have nothing to do with it, but did Gandhi like cricket?
That's a good question. He certainly did not spend a lot of time on it, and given that it was the British game, at that time, I'm sure he would have seen it as some kind of part of the overall British conspiracy to weaken and control India. On the other hand, it's a gentleman's game,
yes.
And he was into gentlemanly things, at least non-violent things, so... But no, I'm sure that he would have seen that as sort of a nefarious plot, really, to undermine resistance to British rule.
Why did you choose to call your book Inhaling the Mahatma?
That title for that book refers to a particular incident where I attended a kind of a delayed funeral for Gandhi, and something unexpected happened. I can't actually tell you because it sort of would completely undo the whole kind of mystery of what it means. But
yeah.
But I think you can probably put two and two together.
Let's talk about firstly his childhood. Did he have a relatively easy childhood?
Well, yes and no. It was easy in the sense that his father was a kind of a diwan in this small town of Port Bandar on the west coast of India, which meant that, yes, they were socially high caste that he was able, for example, to be sent off to England to study law. So on one hand, yes. On the other hand, he was married when he was 13 years old always struggled, and this is clear in his autobiography, struggled with feelings of shame and kind of not knowing whether what to do at the age of 30. He didn't cohabitate until I think they were about 16. But in his autobiography, he goes on at great length about the struggle he had with himself and his body, and what was going on with his with this young woman, Kasturbai, who was his lifelong partner in the end. And also, Gujarat was a fairly arid, kind of free-willing sort of place, and it was under rule by the British, and this became kind of immediately, even at a young age, his teachers were telling him, we've got to do something about this, we've got to start eating meat. Because, the reason the British are in charge here is because they eat meat.
Yeah.
And Gandhis were strict vegetarians. So a kind of an odd mixture of a very sort of, austere upbringing.
Were his parents political? Were they recognising the English rule and not happy with that and didn't particularly like the caste system itself? Or they were comfortable within it?
Oh, look, I think it more the latter, definitely. I mean, most Indians in positions of power were very much concerned with hanging on to those, extending the family's privileges, what there were of them. You don't study law in a country under British rule without, at some level, having to sort of be part of the problem. I don't think he went. He went to England, with that radicalism in him. I think it was something that kind of emerged from the process initially of living in England. You know what it's like when you travel for the first time as a young person. You actually find out who you are and what makes you different from people, even people who you might have had an assumed commonality with. I know when I first went to the UK, it was the first place I went, and immediately, I never really realised I was Australian until I went to the UK. So very much this is what happened to Gandhi.
If he's married at the age of 13 and cohabitating at 16, does that mean that his wife travelled with him to university?
No. He went alone sort of lived the life of the young toff I suppose, in London. He really liked British English clothes, fine, linens and woolen suits and so on. The tradition, the Hindu tradition, very old, of child marriage is kind of a formality. It's a way of the parents sort of sorting things out with the preferred family into which they wish their child to be married early on, and then, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's, they do a sort of a ceremonial deed, and then at some point when the children reach maturity, I think in this case it was around the mid to late teens, the normal sort of marriage then starts to begin.
You don't associate Gandhi as being a person that enjoyed the finer things in life, especially from what he was involved in later in life. There must have been a big turnaround at university at some times, or perhaps later when he went to South Africa.
Yes, it was more when he went to South Africa. I mean, in the UK, he was quite, he really threw himself into the intellectual and cultural movements of the time. And was just really on a real journey of learning. But after he finished his law training, he went back to India, kind of spins his wheels professionally, and then the first twist of fate, I think, a law firm in this small town in which he lives, run by a Muslim, has a case running in South Africa where there's a large Indian community, and so off he goes on a boat the second time. I think it's in the late 19th century. He ends up back in South Africa, and there he finds that, whatever differences he realised there were between Indians and the Brits in London, they're as nothing compared to the sort of discrimination that is affecting Indians in South Africa. And there's a famous incident where, you know, he's thrown off a train, a white passenger boards a train and sees Gandhi, although he's very well-dressed, very well-spoken, a lawyer, an advocate, objects to his presence on the train, calls the guard. The guard says, "Well, Mr. Gandhi, you're going to have to go to the van train." He doesn't exactly throw him off, but the critical thing, Gandhi refuses to get off, get out of the carriage and go to the sort of cheap seats, at which point the guard has no alternative, being pressured by the white passenger to actually remove Gandhi from the train. And he spends a very cold night. He leaves his overcoat on the train by accident. He spends a freezing night in a railway waiting room in an isolated town, and after that he's never the same man. He's absolutely anger. He's got the bit between his teeth, and he's determined to do something about discrimination against Indians in South Africa at first.
We'll drop in and out of the history of Gandhi as we go through the conversation over the next half hour. Eddie joins us. Hello, Eddie.
Yeah, look, in 1982, just after Christmas, being a member of the Wilderness Society, I went down to Melbourne and did MVA training for about a fortnight, non-violent action stuff, all with Gandhi's kind of mantra behind us. And I then made my way over to Tasmania, where in a field there, loaned out by a farmer, we had a tent city, and we all practiced, new people coming into that area had to go through the MVA training before they could join any protests. And every day there were actions, and of course I took part in some of these actions. And you obstructed the police, you obstructed workers, but you never attempted to fisticuffs, or you just be a dead weight, you'd be carried away and so forth, you know.
Eddie, it's a good point that you make, because one of the main things surrounding Gandhi is that idea of non-violent protest. Did that start in South Africa?
In Gandhi's case, yes, this was very much something that came to him in South Africa. It's based, on like a lot of Gandhi's, politics based in some ancient, pretty ancient Indian philosophical kind of ideas. One being that, you do no harm. This is very much deeply embedded in Indian political history. Goes right back to before the time of Christ. There was a Buddhist ruler who really made a big deal of this, out of a kind of regret for deaths during a war, Ashoka. And the wheel that you see on the Indian flag today is not symbolising Gandhi's spinning wheel of simplicity. It actually is Ashoka's wheel of Dharma, which sort of shows how far back it goes. But yes, it did happen in South Africa. Basically, the South African Indian community doesn't really know what to do, but Gandhi's comes along and says, come on, fellas, you know, we've got to do something about this. He's got legal training, so he starts drafting complaints to London because India, South Africa is under British rule. And another twist of fate that was proved, you know, typical of, for the rest of his life, the London Times picks up the story and they support the Indian side. So Gandhi has his first experience with how you can kind of beat the British at their own game and how the media can play a significant role in helping you. And pretty soon he's producing his own newspaper in South Africa called Indian Opinion, which is another part of the non-violent resistance story.
He originally went over as a representative from the law firm in England. How does he then make a living while he's there? Was it originally from that case, but then how did that develop?
Yeah, well, he gets the publicity, he gets the profile, and he starts getting work. And in South Africa, he's not the only person being thrown off trains. And not only that, there's a whole other world of various kinds of discrimination that is afflicting the Indians in that country. So he starts getting lots of legal cases. And, of course, the legal firm that sent him there is very happy. And he ends up spending something like 20 years there. It's a whole big chapter of his life that really made him the man he was, I think, and sets him up, really, for his eventual return to India, where everything he's ever learned, you know, from his the Hinduism that he got at his mother's feet to the kind of knowing the enemy who he discovers in intimate and direct form during his time in England, not an altogether unpleasant form either, this formative time in South Africa where he figures out really what he's going to do with his life.
Michael joins us. Hello, Michael.
Trevor, how are you?
Good.
It's Chris, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep. Chris, terrific to hear you. I haven't heard Gandhi being discussed for a long, long time, and it's amazing you do unfortunately tend to forget if you've studied things a long time ago. I happened to watch a documentary the other night, completely by chance, and decided to stay up and watch the end of it. It was on the civil rights movement and the freedom marches and the bus rides in the US of A, and all the names you sort of came back to memory, and you'd see them in their youth or even in their childhood and then see them as older people, including the guy who sang the song Freedom in the Woodstock movie, whose name escapes me for the moment, and he's a much older man now but still singing with that same passion. Look, one of the things, just as a quick aside, that I just wanted to mention to you, just happened innocently to use the word appropriately in your earlier comments, one of Pav and I's favourite words, nefarious.
Yes.
So I just wanted to acknowledge that, Chris. But look, it's interesting hearing where the ideas about nonviolent action came from, and it's a little bit like Christ too, but watching the documentary, and this is really the reason I brought it up the other night, Gandhi, of course, was a really enormous influence, apart from Christ, on Martin Luther King. And they used the nonviolent protest as well. And one of the women, now an older woman, who was, you know, clubbed and bashed and what have you, as a young girl, just standing watching something, said it took a little while to actually learn to be nonviolent. But on the other hand, the violence dished out towards these people, and it was often the same towards, you know, Gandhi's followers, they were incredibly brave. And the cruelty in that form of racism, and as I watched it, I thought, gee, there's so little knowledge really about why racism is so terrible, even when we had the recent episodes with the AFL with football. But the other reason I wanted to ring just very quickly to finish my comments is I was saying to Pav, one of the sayings that has stuck with me, particularly in recent times with the global financial crisis and the wonderful movie Wall Street, Greed is Good, which is such a brilliant quote to use in that movie. It really sort of got the zeitgeist, I think. But could you elaborate a little bit, if you know much about it, on one of the famous sayings of many of Gandhi's, which is, the worry he had about wealth without work. And there's still a lot of it around, isn't there? A lot of people making a lot of money without doing much work. And it's that concept of exploitation and so on. And sadly, although he had a huge influence, and he's still there if we want to be inspired by him, so many of the great things that he did and others picked up around the world and even the music of the late 60s, has in many ways just been obliterated, I reckon.
Michael, just that quote, Christopher?
Yeah, Gandhi, one of his great talents, like Mao and other world leaders, I think, was that he had this amazing capacity to sort of just encapsulate, a whole complexity of a political idea in just a few words. One of his other sayings, and the ironies of which the caller speaks are also implicit in another saying of Gandhi's, which was picked up by the Apple Computer Corporation and made one of its advertising slogans, which was "Be the change you want to see in the world." This idea of work is deeply embedded in Indian culture. It's in the Bhagavad Gita, something text written 2,000 years ago, in which they say basically, look, you should never work for the fruits of your work. You should always just work for the sort of pleasure and the joy and the satisfaction of actually doing work. Very much deeply embedded in Hindu philosophy, and very much something that Gandhi was raised in. And the caller's other point about the sickening violence that was inflicted upon Gandhi and his followers. This was really a sort of, gut level, just grin and not grin exactly, although even some of them even did grin as they were carted off to jail. This was one of the big challenges, when he first went back to India, there was a lot of anger. This is around the time of the First World War, just after. There was a lot of anger amongst Indians in the Punjab, for example, where a lot of Sikhs, had fought for the British during World War I at Gallipoli as well, and hadn't been the promises of benefits for them hadn't been kept, and so that was one of the first places that where he really tried out this non-violent resistance. And in the Punjab, in 1919, at Jallianwala Bagh, there's a protest march that people are involved in, and the British military officer, General Dyer, just basically loses it and lets it go, and scores of people, I'm not exactly sure, some say hundreds, but at least scores of people are gunned down, shot to death. Terrible scenes. And this one incident really electrifies Indian discontent with British rule. It takes 30 years almost for it to play out with the end of British rule, but it is another one of these signal moments in Gandhi's life and in the life of India's struggle for freedom, which of course eventually succeeds. Mm. But as the caller says, no one person or no one country can change the entire course of human history, and of course India eventually basically goes with the flow like the rest of the world, and we have the world we have today.
Christopher, he must have had an incredible charisma and power and ability as an orator to be able to convince people not to take a violent response but a peaceful response to something like that.
Time and again, it is a massive challenge. It is a struggle. There are critics. There are a lot of people in the Indian freedom struggle. And remember, it was a very, very broad church. It included Hindu nationalists who believed that Hindus should dominate India, not British. And for Gandhi, that wasn't exactly a just outcome. And also, it was a political mistake. And all these kind of religious kind of ideas that he brought into politics, they're a real grab bag. He brought them in because he had one prevailing objective and priority. If he was going to take on the British, Indians need to be united. And India is not an easy place to unite. It's deeply divided by divisions of religion, of caste, of language. And so, his whole project basically was about all the way through, every step of the way, every day, from the moment he returns to India, he is confronted by people who say, no, not that way. We have an overwhelming majority of numbers, advantage of numbers over the small number of British who are ruling us. All we've got to do is just get together, give them a hiding and kick them out of here. But for Gandhi, that was a long-term strategic error, because in his guts he knew that if Indians resorted to violence against the British, even if they got rid of the British, it wouldn't be long before they started fighting themselves.
Yeah, which we've seen in other countries, Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth.
Exactly. And so it's a longer, slower path to freedom. but it works in the long run. And the caller is absolutely right about, you know, Gandhi's long-term influence. Excuse me, Gandhi's long-term influence on leaders like Martin Luther King. Another one you could mention is Nelson Mandela. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You know, they've seen what he did for India, and it's good.
Christopher, because this is a time where there isn't a heck of a lot of tweeting, texting, television. There isn't the electronic means to be able to spread a message as there is today. Did he have a lot of people that helped him spread that message? How did he get that message out there to unify a country, especially with such a large population?
There is radio from the 1930s onwards, but of course that's in the hands of the British.
Yeah.
The two main ways that he does it is through the printed word, the most effectively through Indian Opinion and other journals that are produced by the Freedom Movement. The other way is by adept use of the British controlled media and newspapers. And his way he used the British or the English language, shall we say, media, was by coming up with these ingenious, catchy kind of attention-grabbing acts of defiance. One of the most notable of which was his idea in 1930-31 to set off on a salt march, in which he walks 200 kilometres, with his walking stick. And by this time, of course, he's no longer wearing fine English suits. He's wearing an Indian poor man's dhoti. So off he goes, and there's only a handful of people with him. He's heading for the coast where he grew up. And he's going there because, as a lawyer, he's read the law, and he realises that the British have all kinds of fascinating laws that stop Indians doing all kinds of simple things, because it's all part of the system whereby England takes Indian resources and commodities, ships them off to London in some cases, turns them value adds. Does all the work that makes you rich, and then sends them back and sells them to the Indians. So salt is one of these things that the Indians control, and an Indian is not allowed to make salt. So he says, well, you know, he was very good at seeing the I suppose those laws that were hard to defend in practice. And he seizes on this one. He walks to the coast at Dandy. He picks up a handful of salt. It's against the law, but it's not violent. The security forces arrive. They start pushing people away from the area around the beach. You can see how futile this is in the big picture. They end up turning away, but they walk off to the factories where the salt's processed. There, the police really have to defend the factory because it's private property. And so again, yes, you have these sickening cases where people are hurt. And it was very, very difficult to stand there and watch. And most of all, he's saying, don't get angry. Very, very difficult, detestable. But he inspires people, and they believe they'll do what he suggests. Mm. They believe in him, and it works.
George joins us. Hello, George.
Good morning, Trevor, and good morning, Christopher. Firstly, that previous caller, Michael, is wondering who sang that song Freedom of Woodstock. It was Richie Havens, just to help him out there. But I just might mention to Christopher, I actually went to a talk by one of Gandhi's granddaughters who came out to Australia. So you were inquiring earlier about whether Gandhi was interested in cricket. Well, at this talk that I mentioned that I attended with one of Gandhi's granddaughters, I actually asked her about whether he was interested in sports, and she mentioned, and it was obviously a question, I'm not surprised Christopher hasn't heard much about this, because it's a question that she was a little surprised at, but she thought about it and said, yes, that's right. When he was in South Africa as a young man, he actually helped organise cricket games, ironically enough, and even, I think, a bit of football, and I think it was not a bad spin bowler. But he might not have wanted to mention it, I suspect, for the very reasons Christopher was talking about the cricket being the British colonial game.
But one of the things with that, though, Christopher, I guess he would have also recognised sport being a means of uniting people in a peaceful way.
Yes, I'm sure that's the case, and I was actually involved in the visit of Ila Gandhi, the granddaughter of his, to Australia in February this year, and it was marvellous. We could talk about that for a long time, but yes, it was fantastic. She was a spitting image of Mahatma Gandhi. really funny. I'm walking around with this sort of very diminutive Indian woman, and you kept looking at her, and I thought, my God, look at that gleam in her eye. You know, she's just like her old granddad.
Before we go back to calls, we should talk a little bit about how it was that movement to create independence and to push for independence. How was it that happened, and how peaceful was the inevitable process into independence?
It happened via the an organisation, largely the Freedom Struggle, a number of organisations getting together throughout the 25 years from the early 20s up until 1947. It was a long process. The British tried the usual tactics. There was a period where Gandhi was described as a terrorist by the British authorities, and he and Nehru were routinely carted off and spent years in jail. But ultimately, as the groundswell of opinion is mobilised by Gandhi's leadership and Nehru's leadership, the British start to realise they have to deal with these guys. So they flip the switch towards inviting them to the sorts of talks that are proceeding towards, dominion status and various different types of problems that were being negotiated as they went through. And then, of course, what happens is the Second World War intervenes. A lot of people think that that's where really the Brits lost control of India because, obviously, Britain was impoverished as well as united by its own struggle against Hitler. And by the time you get to the end of the war, Britain is exhausted, doesn't have much money, and I don't think anybody in London, particularly after Labour is elected in 1946, has any stomach any longer for keeping these uppity Indians in their place. And from that point on, it becomes really more of an issue of, well, how are the Indians themselves going to run the country? And this is where one of the great and terrible ironies of Gandhi's struggle starts to emerge, which is that, the Muslim League, which has been founded in 1906 and has always been somewhat uncomfortable with the Hindu kind of texture of Gandhi's philosophy, ends up, prosecuting its case that Indian Hindus and Indian Muslims cannot live together as members of one country. And, of course, the British, in a hurry to get out, some suspicious Indians would say, keen to make sure that the independent India is as divided against itself as possible, agree to Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the Muslim League leader's demand that large areas of western, northwest and northeast India are carved off to make the new country of Pakistan.
David, good morning.
I spent 20 days in India recently, travelling around, and yep. I visited Gandhi's house, which is a museum to him too, and his daughter's house. And the most striking thing was his letter to Hitler prior to the Second World War. Started off apologising to Hitler, not wanting to offend him, etc., but telling him that many people had asked him to write to him. And he was the only man that could save the world from horrific violence and tragedy. And it sort of ended up saying, my dear, basically saying he was my friend Gandhi, sort of thing. That was how he signed it off. But
David, I'll just go back to Christopher because we've got about 6 minutes to the news. Christopher, very quickly, can you tell us about that?
I have heard about that letter to... I haven't read it if I've read it for a long time. But Gandhi was in the habit of corresponding with world leaders and establishing direct lines of communication with them. And it is true, I believe, that happened, that he would try to make a case like that. And, of course, Hitler would have been better off, as well as the rest of us, if he'd taken Gandhi's advice, as on so many things.
Menat, good morning.
I just want to touch on Gandhi's influence. You guys touched on who Gandhi influenced. I just want to touch on who Gandhi was influenced by, and that was Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who started all this rebellion against the Allied forces during the Liberation War of Turkey. Having beaten the Allied forces in Gallipoli, Atatürk then went on to form Turkey, and Turkey was occupied. The Ottoman Empire was occupied by the British and all that. And then he defied them all, and he liberated Turkey and reformed Turkey to become a modern state. I just wanted to touch on that.
Yeah, and good point, because, of course, Atatürk, with that speech that's written in Turkey as well to the fallen soldiers. They were some of his influences, Christopher?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was influenced by a diverse range. He had this talent for picking the essence out of other ideas, other philosophies, whether it was the ideas of a politician like Ataturk or, you know, from the Sermon on the Mount, or, you know, the work of Tolstoy in Russia. These were all very important influences to him, as well as the historical Hindu political influences like Ashoka, the emperor, with his non-violent creed. I think it was really Gandhi's great talent was to pick the eyes out of history and shape it so that it would work in India.
Mm. Ken, good morning.
Yes, I'd like to raise the role of women. Because of his unexclusive nature, he was able to harness the power of women in a very wonderful way. Would Chris have any comment to make on the role of women? The spinning movement, the movement to weave cotton in India so that the monopoly of the import of linen from Manchester would be broken, and of course his exemplary lifestyle with Satyagraha.
Ken, a lot of things there. Firstly, his recognition of the equality for women.
Absolutely. Again, at the core of his political strategy was that you don't you pull people together, Indians of all languages, creeds, and yes, genders. Obviously, he was a man of his age in terms of cultural practices. So he couldn't, for example, say hive off the problem of women and make that kind of the main priority. The main priority was to get freedom from the British. But his movement was utterly dependent and fortunate to have the hard work and the intelligence of thousands, millions of Indian women who, just like men, believed that the struggle for India's freedom went above all other causes, including, to some degree, that particular specific problem of all the discrimination against women that is still to this day troubling India and limiting India. So it's true. I think the great ideas are simple, and Gandhi's idea in its simplicity, it galvanised India and it united India and men and women and children and everybody for that cause.
I've got a text here asking, when was he started to be called Mahatma?
Mahatma came about the time he returned to India from South Africa. He was called the Mahatma by Rabindranath Tagore, who was a philosopher and poet from Bengal. Tagore was India and indeed Asia's first Nobel laureate. And he declared Gandhi the Mahatma. Mahatma is an interesting term, which, even though India is caste-riven, there are all these hierarchical positions that you have from birth. A Mahatma is a person who rises above that structure because of their great acts. And Tagore recognised in Gandhi a very special personality, a revolutionary personality, a visionary, and so he gave him that name.
We're about a minute and a half away from the news. How was it and who was it that assassinated him?
Oh, by the way, it means great soul, Trevor.
Yeah,
Maha,
that's right.
Big, Atma, soul, Maha, Atma, Mahatma, great soul. The assassination, it was carried out by a fellow called Nataram Godse and a few sympathisers. They were of the Hindu nationalist movement, which believed that India should be run by Hindus, not by some, other Western idea like democracy. He attended a darshan or a public gathering that Gandhi used to have all the time. Bowed before him to touch his feet, which is an ancient Indian sign of respect, then shot him in the chest, and the dhoti, the bloodstained dhoti that Gandhi was wearing on that day is also on display at the museum in Delhi.
Was there a period of national mourning?
Oh, my God, I don't think people, when things like that happen, when people like that are lost, there's an absolute spontaneous outpouring of grief that afflicts every people, people everywhere. I think there were 400 million people in India or more when, by the time that Gandhi was murdered. Massive outpouring. But, of course, it occurred just months after the horrors of partition.
Christopher, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us.